welcome our speaker tonight, Kathy from, what's your home group, Kathy? Primary Purpose in Bel Air, Maryland.
Hi, everybody. I'm Kathy. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Kathy.
Thank you very much for having me up. I love coming up here. They have me up here every year. And it's just always an honor to come up and, oh, you dimmed the lights. Romantic. How cool. And the sparkly lights. I'm a short attention span. I can't look at them. My sobriety date is June 15th, 2001. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. I have had the privilege and the honor of sponsoring other alcoholics in this program. I have a home group, Primary Purpose Speakers Group in Bel Air, Maryland. We meet on Tuesday nights at 8 o'clock. If you're ever in the area, please come down and visit us. We love visitors. We love our home group. We have the best home group ever. I hope you feel that way about your home group. If you don't go somewhere else and mess theirs up. Stay and fix yours. I am sober today only because of God's grace and because of the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll try to tell you what it was like and what happened and what it's like today. What it was like and what happened never changes. But today changes on an hourly basis, so I don't really know what you're going to get there. But anyway, I started out, you know, in a really normal family, a beautiful family. I love my family. I can't complain about anything. You know, we weren't rich by far. If you haven't noticed, I'm really not from Maryland. Yeah, it's kind of a speech impediment. You're born with it, you're stuck with it. I grew up in a suburb of Boston. So, yay! If translators will be provided if needed. Anyway, I'm the oldest of three kids. I got a wonderful family. My mother and father were married for 49 years. I'm the oldest of three kids. I got a younger brother and sister. Beautiful neighborhood, you know, nice schools, good neighbors. Nothing to complain about. We were not rich, but all my needs were met and pretty much all of my wants. I was spoiled. My parents were really moral, ethical people, and they were the kind of people that worked hard and they did without so that the kids could have the best of everything. And of course, I never appreciated that. But the reason I tell you all this stuff, and I always start out my talk by telling, you know, what my family was like, is not for your benefit. It's really for mine. It's to remind me that there's nothing external that I can blame my alcoholism on. You know, this is mine and mine alone. I was born with this. You know, I hear people talking about, you know, the child abuse and the broken homes and, you know, and they blame their alcoholism on that. And I had none of that. My parents were very happily married. There was no abuse, no divorce. There's no alcoholism in my family. Anywhere. I'm it. I don't know how that happens. It's supposed to be hereditary, but, you know, it's got to start somewhere, I guess. God willing, it'll end with me, too. But I know that I was born with this. And I used to hear speakers talking about that when I first got sober, you know, saying how they were born an alcoholic. And I'm like, how do you do that? You know, you don't come out of the womb, you know, drinking Jack Daniels. But I get it now, though, because the rest of the world, you know, Wikipedia, Webster's Dictionary, the rest of the world defines alcoholism as an inability to stop drinking. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me that my alcoholism is me suffering from a spiritual malady. And that's how I can say that I was born an alcoholic, because I've always had the hole in my soul. I've always been broken. I always knew there was something wrong with me. I didn't know what. I mean, when you're a little kid, you don't know what's wrong with you. But I knew that I was different from all the other kids. I didn't feel the same. I didn't act the same. I just knew. I knew that there was something wrong with me. But I also instinctively knew that I shouldn't share that with anyone. You know, that was my deep, dark, dirty little secret, you know. And I kept it in my own little prison, my own self-created walls. What that meant that I couldn't tell you that I hurt was that I became a wonderful actress. I do that chameleon thing, you know. I can walk into a room and I can size you up, and in a matter of minutes, I can be you or who I think you want me to be, you know, so that you'll like me. Because I know that if you know who I really am, you won't, because I don't. I don't like me. I didn't, I should say. But I had all these faces that I wore, all these masks that I put on, so that I could prove to you that I was okay. I went to great lengths to make sure that you knew I was okay. My worst fear was that you were going to figure out that I wasn't fabulous, you know? So the mask thing worked a little bit. It worked when I was with a certain group of people. But put me in a big social situation, like the school cafeteria or a school dance or around a bunch of kids. See, because, you know, in school, you got all those cliques, remember? The jocks and the geeks and the freaks and the heads. You know, that's the potheads, the druggies. I love those guys. They were my favorite. They were so cool, you know? Nothing rattled them. I love those guys, you know, until I found out they'd been in the 10th grade for 3 years, you know? But I didn't have any one clique that I fit into. I fit into all of them. You know, everyone was my friend because I couldn't stand disapproval. I couldn't stand for you not to like me. So what would happen is I would be standing with, like, my jock friends because I was a cheerleader and all preppy and nauseating. But I'd be acting all, you know, cheerleadery with my cheerleader friends, you know, and then up would come the heads, you know. And they're my friends, too. And then which mask do you put on? You know, which face do you wear? One of my greatest fears, you know, I was constantly in fear. I remember just looking over my shoulder all the time because I was terrified one of you was going to figure me out for the phony that I was. I could never just be me. It was never okay to just be me. Until I found alcohol. I remember my first drunk like it was yesterday. I was 14 years old. I was at a beach party. I was with some older cousins. They were 16 and 17, and they all drove, and I thought they were cool, so, you know, I had to make them like me. So I decided I was going to get drunk, not have a drink. I could have walked around with one beer all night. Nobody would have known the difference. But I made a conscious decision to get drunk, and I did. I was 14 years old. I weighed about 100 pounds soaking wet, and I drank a six-pack. Immediately blacked out. I love the blackout, by the way. I'm a blackout drinker. I black out every time I drink. I think that's why I drink. I like the blackout. I just want to check out. I don't want to think. I don't want to feel. I just want to check out for. And please don't feel the need to tell me what I did in that blackout. I don't need to know. But that first night, you know, man, I blacked out, and then I passed out, and then I woke up face down in the sand, you know, where they had left me. And good cousins, nice family. But that was the night that it happened, you know? A lot of people say that, you know, that was the night the magic happened, and there was nothing magic about it. That was the night I found my solution. I found my solution for living. It was the only thing that made it okay for me. For the first time in my life, I could breathe. I had no idea until that night when the alcohol hit me for the first time, that I had been living my entire life with a giant fist around my rib cage. Until the alcohol hit me and it released its grip and I could breathe. And my head, oh my God, my head. I'm one of those noisy head people. I know there's none of them in the room. My head never shuts up, you know? It's always racing and always fighting and arguing and talk about committees. You can't compare to mine. But I would do the sickest things. I mean, I would like replay these fights over and over in my head, like fights from 5 years ago, you know, like I was trying to change the outcome somehow. Or I'd pre-fight fights that hadn't happened yet, you know? Did you ever do that? Stand in the bathroom mirror and argue back and forth and play both roles and, you know, I mean, bad shit. But this night, you know, when the alcohol hit me, it was peaceful. It was quiet. All I was getting was just white noise, just static. And that was the effect I sought. You know, the big book tells us that we drink for the effect that alcohol produces. That was the effect I sought. I hear a lot of people at podiums talking about how alcohol made them taller and smarter and better looking and better dancers, and their acne fell off and all that stuff. And I believe that because I hear that a lot. But that wasn't my experience. You know, my experience was I was still short and fat and uncoordinated, but the difference was I didn't care what you thought anymore. I didn't care. It gave me peace. And if I found something that made me feel that good, that made it okay for me to breathe, that made it okay to be me, that I didn't care what you thought anymore, why wouldn't I do that as often as possible, you know? Unfortunately, when you're 14, alcohol's not real easy to get your hands on. It's a lot harder to get than a lot of other substances that are out there. So, you know, I became a real garbage head, and whatever you had, I took. And I didn't care. My one and only love was alcohol. That's where it started, and that's where it ended. But I was that girl. I was that girl that, like, I'd walk into a house party, you know, and someone would say, open your mouth, and they'd throw in a pill, and I wouldn't even ask what it was. I'd just, you know, anything to get me out of me. And blacking out all the time. I loved later on, you know, I found all those other little powdery substances. Those were awesome, you know, because they kept me awake long enough so that I could drink the way I like to. But alcohol was my love. I had a long-standing affair with alcohol. Johnny Walker, my fave. Anyway, jumping ahead, I didn't graduate or didn't go to college after I graduated. I didn't want to waste my time. You know, I'm too smart. I'm not going to waste 4 years of my life sitting in a dorm, you know. So I wanted money. I wanted prestige. I wanted all the things the Big Book talks about, you know. I got a job that I so did not deserve at that young an age. This was back in the 80s. I'm dating myself here, but this was when women were really making a killing in the workforce, you know. And I became killer dragon lady with a briefcase and stilettos and trucking through airports and thought I'd arrived. Thought that that was what I needed. You know, I needed the property and the prestige and all that stuff. I had the business card. I had the company credit card. And I was so alone. I don't know that I've ever felt that kind of lonely. Because I was traveling all the time and I wasn't in any one place long enough to really make any attachments with anyone. It was beautiful for an alcoholic, though, because I didn't have to suffer any consequences. Because I was constantly traveling, you know, I could go out and tie one on and go into a blackout and wake up the next day in my hotel room or wherever. And then I could just pack up and leave and go to the next town. So I didn't have any consequences catching up to me. But all I really saw was the inside of hotels and airports and hotel bars and airport bars. And I drank alone, you know. I was smart enough not to drink with the people that I worked with. Something inside me knew that, you know, they see you dancing on tabletops, they're not going to respect you in the boardroom the next day. So I always, you know, I would have like one glass of wine, you know, because a lot of business deals are made around 6 o'clock, that, you know, happy hour, and we'd sit around and I worked with these, you know, middle-aged gentlemen, and they were gentlemen, and I'd have my one glass of wine, and they'd walk me to my car, and I'd get in the car, and I'd start it up, and I'd wave to them, and I'd wait until they drove off, and then I'd turn the car, and I'd go right back in. And then the company credit card came out, and you know it, my daily food allotment, yeah, it was spent at the bar. But I was lonely. I was horribly lonely. I thought I needed stuff. My parents had nice stuff. My parents, you know, they were happy. Maybe I need stuff too. And I bought this beautiful townhouse, filled it with beautiful furniture and drapes and paintings on the walls and the latest technology, I think, was an A-track at that time. Had the bitchin' Camaro. I had everything, you know, that should have made me happy. All the jewelry, all the clothes. It's just stuff, you know. It doesn't comfort you when you're scared or alone. It doesn't keep you warm at night. It's just stuff. And when you're drunk like me, stuff gets old really quick. And then you just need more stuff. So by now, by this time, I'm like in my late 20s. I've been traveling for about 10 years, and I'm pitifully lonely. Of course, I have to let everybody back home know that I'm okay. you know, I'm calling home every weekend and letting mom and dad know what an awesome life I have. And I'm like, yeah, I'm in Texas this weekend. Yeah, I had the day off yesterday. I went to the Alamo. It's a lot smaller than it looks on TV, you know. I never went to the Alamo. I never left my hotel room. But that's what I do. I have to lie. I have to make you think I'm okay. But all my friends back home by this time, they had all, you know, married Mr. Wright. You know, they met him in college. And they're all settling down and having families and having kids. And I thought, well, that's what I need. You know, I haven't met him yet. And that's actually how I ended up living in the Baltimore area. I was on a business trip down in Baltimore. And I went to a bar one night because that's where you meet Mr. Wright. And sure enough, there he was holding up the wall. That's the one. Gonna marry that one, you know. I don't know how I knew I was gonna marry him, but I did 6 months later. Don't ever do that. That was not a good thing. I don't know what it was. Well, I do know what it was that attracted me to him. He wasn't the most handsome man I ever met, or the richest man, or the funniest man. He wasn't even the nicest man I ever met. He was a bigger drunk than I was. At that point in my life, I was really proud of the fact that I could drink any guy I knew under the table, but not this guy. He was a sun up to sun down drinker, walked around in a blackout half the time. I don't know how he functioned. God bless him. He's still out there today. I pray for him. But I think that I stayed with that man as long as I did because I didn't have to look at me. He was the alcoholic, and he was the reason that we couldn't pay our bills, and he was the reason that I was unhappy. I even blamed my drinking on him, you know, because in the beginning we would drink together, you know, to celebrate our newfound love, and then we drank, I think, to tolerate each other, and then we just drank, and I knew I should have left that guy. I should have left him, you know, right from the start. But see, I'm a nice little Irish Catholic girl from Boston. My family doesn't look kindly on divorce. And I was living in such self-centered fear, I could not pick up the phone and call my family and tell them I made a mistake and I'm leaving. I had to fix the marriage any way I could. So I did what any good drunk would do. And I had a couple kids. Brought some kids. More hostages in the situation. Good God. How horrible is that? How selfish is that? My children were born with a job. My kids were supposed to make me happy. I would love to tell you that that I was a good mother, but I'd be lying, and I don't have to do that anymore. I was a horrible mom, horrible mother. I never spent any time with those children. All they wanted was my time and attention, and I couldn't give them the time of the day. See, what I can tell you, honestly, before God and all you good people, is that my children have never seen me drink, and God willing, they never will. But don't think a day went by that they didn't suffer from the effects of my alcoholism. Because, see, I couldn't drink in front of them. I thought that's what a good mom does. You don't drink in front of your kids. So what that meant was that they were always in my way. Because I got an agenda, you know. I got a date. Johnny Walker's waiting for me in the other room. And I couldn't give them any of my time. So I would put them to bed way before they needed to go to bed, you know, and just so that I could go sit in the other room alone and drink, because God knows where he was, out at a bar or whatever. I think about it now. God, it was terrible. The kids would come home from school. It would start in the morning. I would, you know, wake up wherever I had passed out the night before. A lot of times the kids would wake me up with a bottle of Motrin in their hands. These kids could barely read or write, but they knew what a migraine was. And they knew when not to bother mom. But I would wake up, and I don't even remember brushing their hair or brushing their teeth. I just would stuff oatmeal cookies in their pockets because I convinced myself that oatmeal is a breakfast food. And then I would push them on the bus. And then they would come home from school, and it would be, go outside and play. You need fresh air. But what it really was mom needs a drink while she's making dinner. And then it would be, come in the house, wash your hands, eat dinner, take a bath, do your homework, go to bed. I never said prayers with them. I never tucked them in. I know, go to bed. And kids get older, and they get smarter, and they learn how to tell time. And they're like, really, Mom? It's 6 o'clock. It's still light out, you know? And my response was usually something I can't repeat from the podium. And I would chase them down the hallway with a hairbrush. And I became that mom. And I didn't want to be her. But I have this one vivid memory that I didn't remember in early recovery, thank God, because it has sent me sprinting to the local liquor store. I was standing at the kitchen counter, and I was doing dishes, and my little daughter playing quietly next to me. She wasn't even talking to me. She was just playing with one of her toys. And I reached over her head to put a cooking utensil away. And when I reached over her, that child ducked. There's only one reason kids duck. I didn't want to be her. You know, none of us do. We don't want to be that person. But that's where this thing drives me. Because when I'm in pain, I don't care who I have to run over. You know? Anyway, I was in that marriage 11 years and I finally left them. And I wish I could say that I left for the right reasons, but I didn't. I left because I was going to save my kids from the alcoholic. And I got a little basement apartment in Bel Air, Maryland, and I could only afford 2 bedrooms. And I got a son and a daughter, and I figured kids need the privacy. So I gave them the bedrooms and I slept on the couch for 5 years. And that was the only decent thing I ever did for those children. And I'm not trying to exonerate myself. That's usually where I passed out anyway. But you know how we have these delusions? You know, we think that things are going to get better. I thought that everything was going to change and I was going to be a good mother and we were going to have fun. And, you know, I don't have him to answer to anymore. And I don't have anyone that I have to be accountable to. And I had all these visions in my head. Like I pictured us laying on the living room floor and playing board games and laughing. But I never did it. You know, we're not judged on our intentions. We're judged on our actions. I never took action, you know, never spent any time with them. The one thing that I thought was awesome was that the building that I moved into had lots of other single mothers, you know, and they all had teenage daughters. So babysitters were plentiful. So now I'm never home. I'm off to the races. My kids went from mom they were afraid of to absent mom. And I've got other kids raising my kids. And the thing about, I was noticing things about myself. Like I already hated myself. I never did like myself my whole life. Now I'm doing things that I just know are morally wrong. Like these women in the building, these other single mothers, they're having me over for like coffee on Sunday morning and we're clipping coupons and going through the Sunday paper together and laughing. And they're sharing like intimate stuff with me that you only share with friends, you know? And I let them believe that they were my friend. But I didn't like them, and I really didn't want to be their friends. But I let them think they were because I knew that if I was a friend of the family, they wouldn't let their kid charge me to babysit. And I can see this happening, and I know that this is more. This is not how I was raised. My parents are good people. But I can't help myself because I have to do what I have to do to get what I need. Thank God, God intervened in the form of 2 state troopers. And I remember it was a Wednesday night, and I went to the bar after work. And I remember leaving the bar at 12:30, and I came out of a blackout at 4:30 in the morning, and I'm handcuffed to a chair in the state police barracks, being interrogated by 2 state troopers. Trooper Hooper, I will never forget that man. He was mean to me. But, you know, I come out of this blackout, and I get the pretty metal bracelets on, and I'm like, oh, God, something's really bad here. First question out of my mouth, you know, good alcoholic that I am, I want to know how I'm going to get home. Where's my car? And he yelled at me. I already told you 4 times. It was undrivable after the accident. And I wasn't hurt. I didn't appear to be anyway. And I didn't know what I had hit or who I had hit, but I just knew I was in a whole world of trouble, and I shut up. That was my wake-up call. That was the last time I ever drank. And I want to make it clear, it was not that arrest. It was not the arrest. It was not the pretty metal bracelets. It was not the name in the paper or the trouble with the law. It was none of that. Arrests don't scare us, you know. And good for you going to the jail. I have a jail commitment, too. I love going to the jail. But what it was when they finished processing me, they handed me my paperwork, and they let me go on my own recognizance. Go figure. But then they pushed the phone across the desk at me, and they said, call someone to come and get you. We're not driving you home. And I stared at that phone for what felt like an eternity because I had no one to call. I burnt every bridge. I had no friends. What little family I have is up in Boston, and I'm alone. The only thing that I did have in my purse, I had an employee list of all the people that I work with. You know, for like snow days, you call each other, you know, we're open and late kind of thing. I called every single person that I work with at 5 o'clock in the morning, crying into the phone, please come and get me. And finally, this one woman took pity on me and she came and got me and brought me home. And I walked in the door, and there on the coffee table was the phone book, the Yellow Pages. We didn't have Google back then. But there was the Yellow Pages, and luckily we have an easy name. I opened it up to A, and there was AA, and I called the hotline. And that poor woman, God bless her heart, I'm like sobbing. I think I have a drinking problem. And she says, oh, you poor thing, what's your name? And I'm like, I thought this was anonymous. You know, because I was convinced she knew my ex-husband, you know, and I'm like, but I did call her back, and God bless her, she was patient with me, and she got me to a meeting, and that was where my journey started, you know, that was where it all began. I thought that that was the worst day of my life, if I had only known then what I know now. I thought, I'm never going to go to bars again. I can't go to parties. I'm not going to meet guys. I don't know what I thought I was missing. There was none of that going on anyway. But I thought that I had been sentenced to AA. You know, I thought it was a punishment. I had no idea that I would come alive here. I sat in that first meeting, and the people were so kind. They knew I was a new, I don't know how they knew I was a newcomer. I was not into hygiene at all at that point. It was just like slap on more war paint, bulletproof your hair and out the door, you know. I smelled like a brewery. They gave me a big book though, and they all wrote their names in it and their phone numbers, and which I thought was really nice. I never did call them, but that was nice. But after that meeting, I went home and I had this epiphany. I don't remember anything that was said during that meeting. I don't remember what the speaker spoke about. But for that 1 hour that I sat in that meeting, my head was quiet. And that had never happened before. Not sober, only drunk. I don't know if it was the message that I heard. I don't know if it was being in a room full of my own people and I didn't have to wear masks anymore, or whether it was God that I felt in the room, or whether it was all three. I don't know. I don't care. I felt better when I left that meeting than I did when I went in. And the same has been true to this very day. Every meeting I leave, I always feel better than I did when I went in. Some meetings are like monumental and you leave on such a high. And some meetings are like, somebody's going to drink tonight, you know? But it doesn't matter. I always feel better when I leave, you know? There's something magic that happens here. God lives here. The only thing that I did right was I kept coming back. They told me, keep coming back, honey, it'll get easier. And I did. But that's the only thing I did. I did not get a sponsor. I did not get a home group. I didn't read the big book. I didn't do the steps. I did nothing you people suggested. I think I was trying to stay sober on fellowship. Because it's kind of nice when you show up and people know your name, you know? I guess I thought it was like an osmosis thing. I didn't trust any of you. I wouldn't talk to you because I thought the only reason you'd be nice to me is because you wanted something from me. Because that's how I saw you. You know, if you didn't have anything I wanted, then I didn't waste my time on you. But there were these old guys that sat in the back, these old timers, the three of them, all bald, no teeth. They had about 100 years of sobriety together, the three of them, and they were about 100 years old each, you know. But I knew that there was nothing that I had that they wanted. So I trusted them, and I would sit with these old guys all the time, and God bless them, they saved my life. They knew that I wasn't doing anything, you know. They were kind of crabby and nasty to me at times, you know. Like I would get here when they were already reading the steps and the preamble and the traditions and stuff, and as soon as we said the Lord's Prayer, I'd bolt. And they said, "You're missing the meeting before the meeting and the meeting after the meeting, and they're more important than the meeting in between." And I'm like, you know, I had no clue what they were talking about. They could have been speaking Greek. But I didn't like the manner that they were speaking to me. And I'm a lady, damn it. You know, don't talk to me like that. I got up and I went to the ladies' room in the middle of a meeting once. I will never forget. I sat down next to this old guy. And we called him Popeye. I think he'd had a stroke, one of his side of his face. Anyway, I sat down and Popeye like growled at me. And he's like, don't ever do that again. I'm like, what? I can't pee? You know, what's wrong with you? And he said, God sent you here to hear a message. You're going to miss it in the bathroom. Which I thought was highly unreasonable. But that old man really messed with my program. I haven't been to the bathroom since, you know. But I saw what they were doing, though. They were telling me what I needed to hear, not what I wanted to hear. You know what I mean? They knew that they weren't going to get anywhere killing me with kindness. They kept trying to push me towards women. You know, you need to get a sponsor. You need to do this program. You know, and they would look at me and say, how long are you going to come to a 12-step program and not actually do the thing? I'm like, I read them. You know, I got it. And we sat down after a meeting one night, and I'm ready to bolt again after the Lord's Prayer, and Popeye grabbed me. And he's like, sit down, darling. I'm like, oh, Jesus. And he says, tell me about the first step. I'm like, oh, God, here we go. And I said, I got it. I got that. That's the one that I get the most. I said, it says that we admitted that we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable because we drink. And he looked at me, and he said, you just added a couple words there, honey. It ain't broken, don't fix it. Say it again. We admitted we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable because we drink. And he's like, stop. Just stop right there. Time out. You're missing the whole step. He said, I want you to really read it. He said, it says you admitted that you're powerless over alcohol, hyphen, that your life has become unmanageable. Whenever there's a hyphen in the middle of a sentence, it means that there's two separate thoughts. A, that you're powerless over alcohol. You know that. You got that. You wouldn't be sitting in a church basement at 8 o'clock every night. If you didn't get that, you can never drink again. What you're missing is the second part. Your life has become unmanageable. He said, you're assuming that your life is unmanageable because you drink, and you got it backwards. You drink because your life is unmanageable. And again, he could have been speaking Greek. I had no clue what he meant. And he said, honey, he saw I was confused. He's like, honey, how long have you got now? And I whipped out my six-month coin. I'm like, I got 6 months. I got this thing, you know. He said, if alcohol was your only problem, by now your life ought to be just peachy, huh? I hate when people are right. I could have punched him in the throat because I hurt so bad. I hurt worse than I did the first day I walked in. Because you took away my solution. The alcohol was the only thing that made it okay to be me, and you took that away. And now I'm left with the noise in my head, and the noise is deafening. And I'm in so much pain, I can't stand it. And I thought, maybe these guys know what they're talking about, you know? Maybe I ought to listen. And he started trying to talk about the second and the third step, and I'm like, we are not going there. Because they have the higher power thing in there, and you can't fool me. I know you're talking about God, and I don't want to talk about God. Because I'm one of those people, I would come into the meeting, and I'll listen to your drunk log, and I'll laugh at all the appropriate times. But you talked about God, and I'm in my head doing a grocery list or something. I don't want to hear about God. Because I know God. I've known God my whole life. I was raised in a devout Irish Catholic household. You know, we went to church. Oh, my God. My mother would drag me to confession even when I didn't need to. You know, you're going anyway. I mean, I went to church all the holy days of obligation. I know all the saints and who you pray to for what. And I've never doubted God. I've always known God. We had a beautiful relationship, actually. It was one of mutual indifference. He was up there. I was down here. We didn't mess with each other. You know, he looked like Charlton Heston, and he sat on his little throne up there. And everything I did wrong got written in the book of life, and I was going to hell. And then the nuns, God bless the nuns, they told me that I wasn't only judged on my actions, I was also judged on my thoughts, and I'm like, I'm screwed. But I never doubted God's existence. I always knew he was there, even when things were at their worst, when I was out there in a train wreck. I never doubted God. But the second step says that we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves would restore us to sanity. Well, I've always believed in God, and I've always been nuts. So explain that. And I think they did a very good job, actually. I just couldn't hear it at the time. But they told me that my problem wasn't that I didn't believe. My problem was I had no faith. I didn't trust God. That's why I'd never seen him working in my life, because I never let him in. I was just too busy controlling the show. I think I wanted faith. I really wanted faith at that point. But I had things that I thought were more important than my recovery. I mean, I know today that there's nothing that comes before my recovery. If I lose my recovery, I lose everything. But at that point, I had some serious financial issues. I mean, we all owe money when we get, nobody walks in on a winning streak, you know? So, I mean, we all have debt, but I had some serious money issues. I got, all right, I'm raising these two kids alone, right? We haven't gone to court yet, so I'm not getting any child support because he figured the judge didn't tell me to pay anything. I'm not giving you a dime. So I'm raising these kids on my little salary. I got two attorneys I'm paying now. I got the defense attorney for the DWI, and I've got a divorce attorney for him, you know, and they kind of want their money up front. I had to pay to replace the car that I totaled because I had let my insurance relapse. I had more important things to do with my money. I had to pay to replace the telephone pole I took out. They don't tell you that you have to replace those, but apparently you do. I have all this money going out, and I've got nothing coming in but my little paycheck, and I've got these two little kids that I'm trying. I can't even feed them. I mean, I can't even afford groceries. I'm doing my grocery shopping at the dollar store. These kids are living on dollar store mac and cheese. I mean, a really good day would be like, you know, a happy meal. But that wasn't what was killing me. What was really killing me was the fact that Christmas was in just a couple weeks. And I know I can't afford a tree, let alone put anything under it. And my kids are 6 and 7, and they still believe. And I don't know how to tell these two beautiful kids that Santa's not coming. I'm actually really grateful for that experience now, because looking back on it, that was the first time that I started to realize that my alcoholism didn't only hurt me. You know, I was destroying the people around me too. So I went to one of my meetings one night, and I'm sitting with my little old dudes in the back, and I'm crying, and I'm telling them what's going on and why I'm so upset, and I can't get a sponsor. I can't think about this stuff. You know, I got this shit I got to deal with. And one of them looks at me and says, honey, have you prayed about it? That's what I need, prayer, right? You know, I need cash. Do you know somebody, can you hook me up with a rich sponsor? You know, somebody that can help me out. And he just looked at me like there was something mentally defective wrong with me. He just looked at me and he said, honey, mortal man cannot perform miracles. Only God can do that. I suggest you go home and hit your knees. And I had no other recourse. I mean, I didn't know what else to do, so I did. I went home, and I got on my knees, and I made sure the cat was in the other room because he was looking at me funny. And I said, I think the first honest prayer I ever said, and I just said, God, please spare my kids. Please spare my kids. They don't deserve this. And I said that prayer a couple 100,000 times, and nothing happened. And about 10 days go by, and now I'm ready to open a vein. And I showed up to work one morning, and I opened the place. So I'm supposed to be the only one in the parking lot. I get the keys. But there were three other cars. And when I got out of my car, they got out of theirs. And it was three women. And one I kind of vaguely recognized, but the other two I'd never seen before in my life. And they said, could you come over here? We'd like you to look in our cars. We have something to show you. Every time, those women bought my kids Christmas. Their cars were loaded. They were stuffed. They had bought toys and puzzles and books and games and videos and stockings full of candy and ski parkas and ski pants and boots. And they even gave me a little envelope with some cash in it so I could buy a tree. I found out later on that the woman that I recognized was one of us. She was in the rooms. And the other two women were her mother and her sister, and they were so grateful to AA for giving her back to them that they wanted to donate money to AA, and of course we're self-supporting of our own contribution and wouldn't take it. So this is what they did every year. They found a needy family, and they bought Christmas for that family. And that year they chose us. And I grabbed that woman. And I hugged her, and I cried all over, got mascara all over her shirt. And I tried to thank her, and she wouldn't let me thank her. She said, honey, you can't thank me. I was once in your shoes, and this was done for me. So I said, okay, you won't let me thank you, but I'm going to pay you back. It may take me 20 years, but I'm going to pay you back. And she said, you don't get it. That's not how it works. She said, you haven't been around long enough, but in AA, we don't pay it back. We pay it forward. Keep doing what you're doing. Stay sober, work a program, get with a good sponsor. And she said, one day when you're ready, God will put someone in your path, and it'll be your turn to pay it forward. I'll tell you, my feet did not touch the ground for the rest of that day because two important things happened. A, my faith in humanity was restored. Because I forgot that you're all good and kind and loving people and you just want to help each other. Because I was so bitter and broken and jaded, I couldn't see you. But the more important thing that happened was that my faith in God was restored. Because I know who those three women were. They were the answer to a drunk's prayer. I didn't ask for anything for me. I asked God to spare my kids, and he did. And there was nothing under that tree that year with my name on it. And I was the richest woman in the world just looking at those kids' faces. Oh, God, I'm so sorry. Isn't gratitude a wonderful thing to be able to cry over the good stuff today and not all the crap? Or it could be menopause, I don't know. Anyway. But I'll tell you, I didn't know what you people had, but whatever it was, I wanted it. And as soon as that Christmas was over, I dove into this program. I jumped in feet first, and I haven't ever left. You guys taught me how to live again. You didn't give me my old life back. I don't want that. You gave me a new, beautiful, shiny way of living. I got with the sponsor. They kept pushing me towards this woman, and I hated this woman. Everywhere I saw her, she was always so freaking happy. You know, I thought, there's no way anybody can be that happy. She's got to be medicated, right? But I really thought she was. I finally asked her to sponsor me, and she was like, I'd love to. It would be my honor. And I was like, eh. But she brought me to her house to do step work, and the first thing I did was I excused myself to go to the ladies' room, and I went through her medicine chest, not because I wanted to take anything. I wanted to see what she was on. But apparently that's what serenity looks like, so I had to make an amends. But she was beautiful. You know, we went through the steps together and we went through the big book together, but she wasn't like a big book Nazi. She didn't make me study and memorize. And she taught me life lessons by living. Like, for instance, we went to this meeting. Now, everywhere we went, she knew everyone. She knew everyone in the room. We went to this one meeting in downtown Baltimore. There had to be 200 people in that room, and she knew every single person. And I'm like, it would really piss me off. And I'm like, how do you do that? I want friends. You know, how do you do that? And she said, I see you with that little white fold-out card, you know, and you're always getting women's names and numbers, and you carry it with you everywhere you go. How many of them have you called? Well, none. I thought that was for emergencies. And she's like, I'm giving you your first homework. I want you to pick five people off of that list, five women. I want you to call the same five women for the next 10 days straight. And I said, and talk about what? And she said, I don't care, as long as it's not you. Ask them how their day is, what's going on in their life. Ask how they are. And I'm like, oh, Jesus. But see, that's my problem. I don't know how to live. Some people don't adult well. I don't life well. I don't know how to talk to you. I don't know how to communicate. I really didn't want to call those women, but I wanted what you had, you know, and I was desperate. So the first phone call was horrible, you know. I'd be like, hi, it's Kathy. Oh, my God, are you going to drink? No, I just called to say hi. Bye, you know. And then as the days went by, like, the conversations got easier, and we talked about, like, husbands and ex-husbands and boyfriends and bosses and kids. And then we had conversations, you know, and we started talking, and 10 days went by pretty quickly, and day 10 came and went, and I was like, thank God that's over. I don't have to do that again. Day 11 came. I didn't call anyone. Nothing happened. Beautiful. Day 12 came. My phone blew up, and it was those five women, and they wanted to know why I didn't call the day before, and they wanted to know if I was okay. And I realized that I had friends, but more important, I learned that if I wanted to have friends, I had to be one first. And that's how she taught me. She taught me how to live, by watching her and by watching you. That's how I've learned all the important lessons, by watching you, because I see you. You know, not just in here. Our recovery is not what we do for an hour a day in here. It's what we do with the other 23 out there. And I see you in the grocery stores, in the churches. And you really do live this thing. And you really do care. And I wanted to be just like you. Life got really good really quick. But I don't want you to think that life doesn't happen. You know, life shows up. Sometimes life does not steer clear of us just because we're sober. You know, you don't walk into AA, get struck sober, and then life is all rainbows and unicorns. And that just doesn't happen. That's not reality. Sometimes bad stuff happens. That's not God. That's just life. I've been through a bunch of stuff in recovery over the years. I buried my dad. That was really hard. He was very sick. So, you know, first we're praying for God to take him, then we felt guilty and we're, you know, asking God for forgiveness for asking him to take him, and, you know, but I didn't have to go through that alone. You guys were there with me and you walked with me, and it was okay. 6 months after my dad died, I went to what I thought was a routine annual physical, and turned out not so routine. God, why do I even bother wearing makeup? Do I look like Alice Cooper yet? Am I okay? You don't know who Alice Cooper is, do you? Too young. Anyway, I found out 6 months after my dad died, I found out I had breast cancer. And it's okay. Girls are good. Got to keep them. But that was a really interesting journey, you know? I wasn't sure what was going to happen. I wasn't sure mentally, spiritually, physically. I wasn't sure if I was going to make it, number one. I wasn't sure what kind of mental state I was going to be in. And anyway, I told all the women that I sponsored that I couldn't sponsor them anymore. I'm like, I think you need to find somebody else because I just don't know what's going to happen to me. Not one of those women fired me. But not only that, they showed up for me. They made sure that, you know, I got to my surgery, that I got to my doctor's appointments, that I got to all my treatments. My immune system was shot, so I couldn't go out in the public. So they brought meetings to me, and I wore my little surgical mask so I wouldn't catch any germs. And then when I was healthy enough, they took me out to meetings and made sure that I was okay. But the beautiful thing that happened there was that line, that imaginary sponsee line, you know, it was erased. And they just became my sisters, you know. And it was then that I realized that God's the only sponsor. We're just a room full of drunks trying to help each other, you know. It was a beautiful thing. I went through a depression in recovery, too, a horrible depression. I didn't know what the hell was wrong with me because I thought I was doing all the right things. But I ended up, I was really detached from God. And I found out that a lot of people do that. A lot of us bottom out spiritually in recovery. Stone cold sober, you should not want to shoot yourself in the face. But apparently a lot of us go through that. Thank God that there are people in this program that actually pay attention. You know, that really practice the 12-step, and when they ask how you're doing, they listen for an answer because they called me out. Because I was telling everybody I was fine, and they were like, your eyes are dead. You are not fine. And they surrounded me with love. And I found I needed a new experience. And I got myself a new sponsor, and I started over like I was a newcomer. I've never done anything to warrant picking up a 24-hour chip, but I felt like I should have because I died inside. And I never would have made it if it wasn't for you. Thank God I never left these rooms. You guys have always been here for me. Just it'll be 2 years tomorrow. 21st of December, 2014, my stepson died, overdosed, heroin overdose. And he was one of us. He was in the rooms. And we still don't know what triggered his relapse, but that was hard. I've spent the better part of the last 15 years trying to help others, and I couldn't reach one of my own, and it was devastating. That day, I don't know how the people in AA found out, but I mean, as soon as the sheriff's department left, AA was in my door. And the front door to my home was like a revolving door all day long. Every hour you came in shifts, and I wasn't alone. And all his friends showed up, all his friends from the program, and it was really cool because we didn't sit there and cry and mourn. they told me like all the funny Brandon stories, you know, the stuff that the moms don't hear about, you know, and we laughed and we celebrated his life and it was beautiful. And they all keep in touch with me and I see them and it's a beautiful thing. And I don't feel bad for him because I know that he's happy. He's probably having a beer with Jesus. You know, I know he's okay. My dad was up there to meet him when he got there. We miss him. And it's okay to shed tears. I know that death is not an ending. It's just a doorway. And we're all going to be together again someday. I'm not trying to point out all the bad things about because my recovery's been awesome. I love my life today. I wouldn't trade it for anything. I am getting to a point, though. I was one of those people that never felt like I fit in anywhere. I never belonged. I was always lonely. I never belonged. Ever since I came here, I've been home. I never have to walk alone again. I have a wonderful relationship with a God that I reintroduced myself to. And we have a very real and tangible relationship. And he walks with me everywhere I go. Because I'm human and crazy comes back quickly, sometimes I can't hear his voice. I have a hard time hearing him. And so I come here and he talks to me through you. I have never, ever been alone. What a comfort to know that I never have to be alone again. As long as I stay here, I'm home. That's a gift I so do not deserve, but that's grace. A gift I don't deserve, but I'm glad God thinks I do. Oh my God, it's 9 o'clock. Can I finish? Real quick, I just got one thing to tell you and then I promise I'll shut up. The greatest gift I was ever given in AA happened when I was about 3 years sober. I walked into a meeting late, sat down, because I'm late everywhere I go, and I'm talking to my friend, and I'm taking inventory around the room. They're reading the steps, right? And I'm looking around the room, seeing who's here and who's not, and they're holding hands, so they must be hooking up, and, you know, she's got a haircut, looks good, you know. But I look over, and there's this girl sitting a couple seats over from me, and I love this girl. I don't really know her. I just know her to say hi to her in the meetings, but, you know, but she's, I love this girl. She's always bright and shiny and glowing and happy, and she's tall and blonde, and she's got legs up to her armpits, and she's everything I always wanted to be, you know? And she's only got, like, about 3 or 4 months sober, but she's one of those girls that really got this thing, you know? Every time I see her, she's driving by the halfway houses and picking up girls and bringing them to meetings, and she's always on fire. But this night, I almost didn't recognize her because she's a train wreck. She wasn't crying, but it was very obvious she had been. You know, her eyes are all red and puffy, and her nose is swollen. And so I look at my buddy, and I'm like, what's going on over here? You know, should I talk to her? Can I help? And he said, I don't think you can help. He said, but you do need to talk to her. Someone's got to talk to her. And I'm like, all right, well, what am I walking into? Did she relapse? Is it a guy thing? What's going on? And he said, nah, it's not like that. He said, she's a young single mom. She's got a couple of young kids. She's going through a horrific divorce. She's having money problems. She can't feed her kids. He said, as a matter of fact, the home group has a collection going. We're going to go grocery shopping, get some food in the house for those kids. You want in? And I'm like, yeah, been there. No problem. And I picked up my suitcase of a purse, and I'm a wicked debit card person. I never carry cash. So I'm digging through the thing, and I'm looking for change at the bottom, you know, and kids inhaler, hairspray, everything's coming out. And while I'm doing this, he's still talking. And that's when I heard it. He said, that's not what's keeping her up at night. The reason she's crying is because Christmas is in a couple weeks. My heart stopped because I knew it was my turn. It was my turn to pay it forward. I've got a friend up in Boston that always says that God does not need our permission to use us. And I know that my friend Danny had no idea that God was using him that night, but I recognized God's voice when I heard it. So I gave him what little change I had, and I'm like, here, you do the food thing. I said, I got the other thing. And he's like, you sure? I'm like, yeah, I got it. And I never did talk to her. I bolted because Target was open. I had to get there before they closed. But the next morning, I found her house, and I went over there, and I called her outside to come and look at my car, And she did what I did. She just, like, stared for a minute in disbelief or shock or whatever. And then she fell to pieces. And she just fell in my arms and started sobbing. And she tried to thank me. And I said, you can't thank me. I was once in your shoes, and this was done for me. And then she wanted to pay me back, and she wanted to clean my house and do my laundry and stuff. And I'm like, stop, you know, it doesn't work that way. And I was blessed enough to be able to tell her what those women had told me 3 years before, you know, that we don't pay it back in AA, we pay it forward to keep working her program. And someday God would put someone in her path and it'd be her turn. I still get a Christmas card from her every year. She's still sober. And 3 years ago, she got a chance to pay it forward. What a beautiful gift. But that wasn't the gift I was given. This is the gift. When I was driving home and I was leaving, and I'm looking at her, thinking about her, you know, looking at her in the rear view and wondering what's going through her head. And well, I knew what was going through her head. I was her, you know? And I knew that she thought she got the gift that day. But now I knew what those three women knew, and that's that I got the gift that day. You know, that I realized that it's in the giving that we receive. And you've been trying to tell me that my whole life, and I never heard you because I was so self-consumed and so self-absorbed, I couldn't see you. Life is so beautiful and it's so short. And that's all God wants from us, is to take care of each other. He just wants us to help our brothers and sisters, you know, help the rest of God's kids. And it's not the big things. It's not the, you know, buying somebody Christmas. That was a one-shot deal. It's all the little stuff, you know, the, hey, I'm going for coffee. Can I get your refill? Or we're going out after the meeting. Do you want to come with? Or I know you probably got a sponsor. Can I get your number anyway? I can always use another friend. You know, pay attention to each other. This thing that we have kills. It kills people. I'm so tired of going to funerals. It's a beautiful, beautiful way of living. And if there's anyone in here that doesn't feel about their program the way I've been talking about mine, you need to get with somebody who has that glow, that shine, you know, that looks like they're actually enjoying their recovery. And hang on to them like your life depends upon it, because it does. Thank you for letting me share.